Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Some scientists say climate change may be the greatest challenge the human race has ever faced. But while politicians debate how to respond, the world's ice is melting. Glaciers everywhere are shrinking at an alarming rate. In a new book, geophysicist Henry Pollack explains the great melting that's taking place all over the world and why decisions we make today will shape the world and human society for thousands of years to come. He joins me in the studio, and we're talking about a brand new book he's written. It's titled A World Without Ice. The foreword to the book has been written by former Vice President Al Gore. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Dr. Pollack. Thanks for being here.
Good morning to you, Diane, and thanks for having me.
I think perhaps there are a lot of people who might want to have you answer a very basic question. Why is ice so important to our existence here on Earth?
Ice is important in a number of ways. First and foremost is that ice is a major component of our global climate system. Because ice is so reflective, it's almost like a mirror, incoming sunshine, which is, of course, the source of what keeps our temperature equable, is reflected away by ice. And if there's more ice, we don't get as much warming sunshine. And if there's less ice, we get more. So it's an important part of the climate system. The second thing about ice that is particularly interesting to me is that it's a very sensitive indicator of climate change. Because ice is so close to its melting point over much of the Earth, small changes in temperature can lead to substantial losses of ice. And the third major point is that the consequences of losing our ice are great. The loss of mountain glaciers will mean the loss of agricultural water and domestic water for as much as a quarter of the globe's population.
How so? Explain that third point.
I will. The many of the streams that provide the water that we use in agriculture and for domestic purposes have their origins in the highlands of the globe, in the Himalayan mountain range, the Tibetan plateau, high up in the Andes. And although there's snowfall each year, that doesn't provide all of the water that the human population uses below. There's a very slow melting of the glaciers as well. That melting is accelerating. And as a result, at the rate at which we're losing that glacial ice, we'll no longer have that in another 2 to 3 decades. And that means a great and sudden loss of water for a big chunk of the global population.
What does that rapid melting mean for sea level, for example? What does it mean for providing perhaps more water for farming? Perhaps there's a good side to it.
There is a good side to it while it lasts. And that is that with additional melting, the water supply looks like it might even be in greater abundance than it is. But once the glacial contribution is gone, there's a sudden cutoff. And the only thing that comes down the rivers then is the snowfall, the annual snowfall that melts over the watershed. And without the glacial contribution, the water supply will be greatly diminished. Now, the second point that you raised is, where does the water go? And the water goes into the ocean, ultimately, and sea level will rise. Sea level has already risen. Throughout the 20th century, sea level rose about 8 inches, and it's continuing to do so now. And the projections for the end of the 21st century are anywhere from another 3 to 6 feet of sea level rise at the end of this century. And that's no laughing matter. It'll be a great encroachment of the sea onto the land. And there are many millions of people that live close to sea level and will face the dislocations that come with rising sea level.
Henry Pollack is professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan. He serves as science advisor to Al Gore's Climate Project Training Projects and was a member of the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Do you see the pace of the melting accelerating? And if so, why is that happening?
The pace of the melting is accelerating. The pace in the first half of the 20th century was slower than that in the last half of the 20th century. And in the last half, the pace at the end of it was greater than at the beginning. So we are seeing an acceleration of melting. And it's largely due to the fact that temperatures on Earth are climbing. And it's getting warmer and warmer, and more ice reaches its melting point and will be contributing water to sea level.
How much is the temperature rising?
Well, the temperature has risen in the last century about 1 degree Celsius or close to 2 degrees Fahrenheit.
Now, why should that make such a difference?
With ice being so close to its melting point, every increment of temperature brings more melting. And it's not just the new water that is raising sea level, but the warming of the seawater itself is a contribution to rising sea level, because seawater expands when it gets warmer. And as the oceans warm, just like the atmosphere is warm, just like the rocks beneath the surface have warmed, as the oceans warm, they expand. And so you have two contributors to rising sea level: new water from the melting ice, and additionally, warming of the ocean water itself.
Now, there are an awful lot of people out there, Dr. Pollack, who you know as well as I do, who believe that no such warming is taking place, or if there is such warming, it's not damaging, that it will actually help the Earth, that more plants will grow, that there will be a more comfortable climate for human beings and for animals, as well as vegetation. How do you respond to that constant barrage of criticism?
I respond to it every opportunity that I get, because I recognize that the public is puzzled and confused by the barrage of misinformation that clouds the real scientific facts. Let me say, in addressing the first question you raised about how real the warming is, the 2007 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which I think is the definitive scientific statement about the state of our climate, that report said that the reality of warming is unequivocal. Now, that is about as strong a word as you'll ever hear a scientist or a group of scientists say. That means there can be no confusion about it. There can be no mistake about it. It is as real can be. And it comes not from a single line of evidence. It comes from many lines of evidence that together weave a fabric of considerable strength to support the statement that the warming is unequivocal. We have the melting of ice, of course. We have the rise of sea level. We have the measurements of temperature in the atmosphere, in the oceans, in the rocks beneath the surface, all of which are telling us that the temperature is rising. And in addition, we have nature's own thermometers. We have flowers that are blooming earlier in the spring. We have birds that are laying their eggs earlier. We find rivers are freezing later in the fall and breaking up earlier in the spring. Nature is talking to us, and we ought to be listening to nature and not so much to the political debate.
Now, that political debate also includes a statement challenging that, quote, unequivocal statement, saying that there are thousands of scientists who have not signed on to that argument.
I am not so interested in the numbers of scientists on one side or the other. I again come back to the evidence, the scientific evidence, which is so broad and comprehensive and overwhelming that we have a not a consensus, but a unequivocal statement.
Henry Pollack, he's professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan. His new book is titled A World Without Ice. I hope you'll stay with us. Welcome back. If you've just joined us, Henry Pollack has been science advisor to Al Gore's climate project and was a member of the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His brand new book has a stark picture on its cover, with good reason. The book is titled A World Without Ice. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Dr. Pollack, before the break, we were talking about, well, so what if it gets warmer? So what? Maybe the flowers will bloom longer. Everything will be a little more comfortable.
I think that as we approach winter, that might sound good for those of us that undergo winter. But you have to remember that it's not just a warmer winter that comes with a warmer world. There'll be warmer summers. And the big cities of Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, New York, which may experience a few days above 90 Fahrenheit in a typical summer, may experience 30 or more days in a warmer world. In terms of the agriculture, it is certain that more carbon dioxide is a foodstock for green plant growth. But it's not the only one that is required. You need more nitrogen of the right type. You need more water to guarantee that the crops will grow. And so simply increasing one component of the diet does not guarantee additional growth. And moreover, it's not just the good plants that might like to grow. Weeds will as well, and perhaps more competitive invasive species will do better where you want a particular crop to grow. It may be a loser. So there's many, many aspects about a warmer world that make it not such a paradise, not a return to the Garden of Eden that some have said.
Here's an email, and I'm not quite sure how this goes. It says, if all the proposed climate changes are put into place right now, what kind of a change could we expect to see, and how fast? Now, I gather what this is implying, or at least I'm inferring from it, is the proposed changes like cap and trade, caps on the emissions, and so on. Is
right.
that how you understand
That's how it? I would interpret
okay.
it. And your listener asks a good question. I'm going to interpret it as asking, how much time do we have to perhaps turn the great ship of climate away from dangerous shoals? And one way of looking at it is that various scientists have said that the level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere should fall somewhere, should be stabilized in the range of 350 to 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide, the principal greenhouse gas. Well, today we're at 390, so we're well past the 350 that some people think is already too much. But the upper limit, the 450, is still 60 parts per million away. Now, we are adding 2 to 3 parts per million every year. And so you can do the arithmetic. We have 20 to 30 years to stabilize the emissions so that they do not exceed that upper limit, that dangerous limit of 450.
And what would exceeding that upper limit of 450 mean for human beings and the way we live?
I think that perhaps the biggest effect, and that felt by the greatest number of people, will be the possibility that sea level will rise very rapidly. Already we're going to see sea level rise, partly in part because of what we have already done to the atmosphere, and partly because we're going to continue to have some emissions because we just can't turn them off overnight. And the changes that might exceed those that we already anticipate are if bigger chunks of ice start to leave Greenland and West Antarctica. Each of those regions has the equivalent of about 20 feet of sea level change. And if either one sheds large amounts of ice, and we're looking at many feet of sea level change, we're talking about affecting hundreds of millions of people who live close to sea level.
And what about the creatures living at either pole of the Earth?
Already we're seeing changes in the wildlife as they adapt to changing conditions. The area that I'm most familiar with is the Antarctic Peninsula, which is home to tremendously abundant wildlife. People think of Antarctica as a cold desert, but it is rich. I call it the frozen part of the Garden of Eden. And already in the few decades that I have been visiting Antarctica, I've seen big changes in the penguin population. The Adélie penguins like a lot of sea ice. The chinstrap penguins don't care that much about sea ice. And so the populations have shifted from abundant adelies and some chinstraps and Gentoo penguins to just the other way around. The adelies are getting harder and harder to find on the peninsula. Now, in the Arctic, we're discovering that sea ice plays an important role in the feeding habits of seals and of polar bears and walruses and the like. And as less and less sea ice is found in the Arctic, we're finding that those species are struggling as well and trying to find new places where they can find a good living, so to speak.
You know, you used the word adaptation. Now, perhaps, again, from those who would say, I'm not going to worry about this, there's no need to worry about this. Human beings and the creatures of the earth can adapt, and that's all there is to it. Why worry?
Indeed, human beings have adapted in the past. When ice came and went in the ice ages and our ancestors were struggling for an existence in hard times, they didn't have permanent structures at sea level. And if sea level was rising, they picked up and moved. Today, we have, of course, many, many more people on Earth. And we are not free simply to pick up and move as climate might dictate. The social consequences of 1 meter or 3 feet of sea level rise is to displace 100 million people around the globe. Where do they go? Who's going to welcome them? Do they move inland to Michigan, where I live? Do they move further west in Virginia? It's not as if there's unoccupied territory that climate refugees simply move to. Our whole social structure will be severely tested as we have climate refugees moving inland from sea level rise.
Is population growth the primary concern for the rising of the temperature on the globe?
Population growth, of course, plays a big role. Our population has skyrocketed in just the last two centuries. In 1800, Earth's population was 1 billion people. It took 130 years to add another billion to 1930. But then we've added another billion and another and another and another in shorter and shorter time intervals, so that today we're at just short of 7 billion people, and the last billion was added in only 12 years. So population growth is big, but energy usage is also big. Every generation uses more energy than the previous one, and so it's a combination of the growth of population and the increased use of energy that is fueling, if I may use that word, the climate change.
Here's an email from Rich. He says, ice requires substantial heat energy just to melt without any change in temperature. Thus, as ice melts, it absorbs heat energy associated with global warming. Once the ice is gone, will global temperatures rise even more rapidly? How big will this effect be?
The observation is correct. The energy that is required to melt ice is called the latent heat. And when there's no more ice to be melted, then latent heat the Earth, or that would be used in that process, will simply warm the Earth even more. But the time scale for ice loss is, I think there are three time scales, and I call them the decadal time scale, the century time scale, and the millennial time scale. For the decadal time scale, we're going to see the loss of mountain glaciers in a few decades. We're going to see an ice-free Arctic Ocean in the summertime. There'll be no sea ice in the Arctic Ocean in the summer. Both of those are on the decadal timescale. Losing Greenland's ice and West Antarctica's ice will take a few centuries. And to lose East Antarctica's ice, which is the big ice pile in Antarctica, probably is 1,000 years away. So the problem that your listener mentioned won't go away until the last piece of ice is gone. And there's a considerable amount of time left before that happens.
So that listener may say, so why are you bothering me with this now?
I could certainly, I don't know where your listener lives, but if I knew where your listener lived, I would tell him some things to worry about right at home. If he lives near the sea, rising sea level. If he's in an agricultural state in the Midwest, I'd be very worried about changes in precipitation patterns and invasive species. If he lives on the Great Lakes, I'd be worried about lower lake level.
Henry Pollack is professor of geophysics at the University of Michigan. His new book is titled A World Without Ice, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have a great many callers. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Dora, who's in Danville, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane, and it's a pleasure to be with you and Dr. Pollack.
Thank you so much.
I have been a traveler to Nepal since 1990s, and I was able to go in 2008, and we have always observed the Himalayas. And this past year, we noticed that the snow is melting on the Himalayas. And I don't know if Professor Pollack has been able to notice that or has any records of it, but it was a heart-wrenching reality to know that this is happening. And I don't think we need to have a tremendous, research has been done to prove to us that this is happening, that global warming is here because of the ever-growing demand to supply for our ever-growing population.
Certainly the observation that the snow and ice in the high Himalaya is diminishing, that has been observed by Asian scientists on both sides of the mountains. And it's a reality that you observed, and as it continues and that snow and the residual glacial ice is gone, it'll have a big effect on the flow of every river that has its headwaters in the Himalaya.
So what is that going to mean for the population in that area?
Once again, it has to do with their agricultural water and their domestic water. Effectively, all the water they use tumbles down from the high Himalaya. It's augmented by rainfall, of course, and such, but a substantial part of it comes from the high snow and ice. And when that's gone, we're going to definitely impact the water supply of the region.
Dora, thanks for your call. Here's an email from Ernest, who's in Silver Spring, Maryland. Please discuss the late Carl Sagan's theory that the Earth could end up like the planet Venus, enshrouded in CO2 and hotter than the planet Mercury, yet being further away from the sun.
Surely. The Venus and Earth are very similar as planets. They're about the same size. They are made up of mostly the same stuff. And we're second and third rock from the sun, roughly similar distances. But, of course, Venus is very, very different in that it has a very thick atmosphere of mostly carbon dioxide and, therefore, a very thick greenhouse blanket that has raised the temperature several hundreds of degrees and makes Venus, a hothouse. Earth, on the other hand, has a very thin atmosphere made up mostly of nitrogen and oxygen with just a little carbon dioxide and a few other greenhouse gases that altogether are less than 1%. And so we have a very modest greenhouse, and The difference is that Earth has water at its surface, and Venus is too hot for water. Venus has lost its water. Now, Carl Sagan said that Venus was the victim of a runaway greenhouse that effectively put all of its carbon into its atmosphere. Earth has other ways of storing carbon. We have it in ancient carbon deposits, what we call coal and petroleum. We have it locked up in limestone, which is a rock that has the composition calcium carbonate. And so most of Earth's carbon is stored in rocks.
Now.
But we're busy taking it out of the rocks and sending it back into the atmosphere. And that's the concern.
Henry Pollack, his new book is titled A World Without Ice, something that I personally do not want to contemplate. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids and families succeed at aecf.org. By the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Gruber Family Foundation, to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Of the next Fresh Air, an investigation into what really happened 1 year ago during the financial collapse and bailout. We talk with Andrew Ross Sorkin, a financial journalist with the New York Times and author of the new book Too Big to Fail, the inside story of how Wall Street and Washington fought to save the financial system and themselves. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, Henry Pollack is with me. He's professor of geophysics at the University of Maryland. He serves as science advisor to Al Gore's climate project and was a member of the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Here's an email on that very subject from Peter. He says there were a number of scientists on the IPCC who did not endorse all the group's conclusions. Now, there are credible reports that over the last several years, global temperatures have declined. I am an engineer with lots of experience in data analysis. Where can I find the data? I need to understand what's happening so I can know what to think.
The data is publicly available and resides in the USA at the National Climate Data Center, which is accessible simply on the web. And you can get the daily, monthly, yearly temperature time series for many, many weather stations around the country. And you can also get the national and global averages and such.
Do you agree with his statement that in recent years the temperature has declined?
Let me comment on that. Every year there's temperature change. Some years it goes up, some years it goes down. And from the point of view of the climate, we're interested in the long-term trends. And so,
not the daily weather forecast.
That's right, and not whether this year was a warm year or that year was a cold one. Now, the listener remarked that the last decade, the temperature has not gone up. And that's true. It has been fairly stable, but it's stable at a very high level. And that the last decade is, in fact, the warmest decade since we've been keeping weather station records around the globe.
I see.
And so what people point to is that it hasn't continued to increase dramatically over the last decade. But there have been many examples of a pause or even a decline of temperature or a rapid increase beyond the rate that is the long-term average. And so we just have to keep our eye on the long-term trends and not worry too much about what's happening year by year.
So the long-term trend indicates from when to when that the temperature has risen some 2 degrees Fahrenheit.
The 20th century is that record.
20th century.
Right.
All right. Let's go to Brookport, Illinois. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
I'm calling from WKMS in Murray State, where you haven't been on real long, but I've enjoyed the show.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
I just wanted to ask Dr. Pollack about whether in his discussions with his colleagues, what the role globally of forests and forest protection might be in helping to stabilize the climate.
The role of forests is big. It's not as big as the use of fossil fuels, but about 20% of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has come from deforestation, which means that the trees are no longer there to pull the carbon dioxide out, and therefore it's staying in the atmosphere. So it's one part in five, which is non-trivial. And so it also tends to suggest that if we were to have a reforestation program of the magnitude that has been deforested, that it would be a substantial contributor to pulling down the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. This is called biological sequestration. It's not the only type of biological sequestration. There's also thoughts of encouraging the ocean biota to take up more carbon dioxide through fertilization of the oceans. And some experiments have been undertaken on that, not fully successful, because it did not lead to long-term sequestration. It led to a temporary pull-down, but quickly was returned to the atmosphere.
So you really have to have massive reforestation around the globe if you were to truly make a dent in the problem.
That is true. We have seen tremendous deforestation in the Amazon, in some of the Central American countries, in Madagascar, in Indonesia, and it's not just planting trees in America, but it's impressing the nations that have the big forestation to recognize its value and not just simply go to cutting it down for timber or for agricultural land.
Mark, I'm glad you called. Thanks for listening. Let's go now to Brattleboro, Vermont, and to Michael. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane and Professor Pollack. I'm glad to talk with you. I have a question relating to permafrost. Can you hear me okay?
Surely. Go right ahead.
Great. My understanding is that the increased exposed tundra and exposed ocean and reduced ice cover will add to the amount of solar heating effect during the summer months when the North Pole is pointing towards the sun. And I'm thinking about the vast number of square kilometers of the frozen tundra across Siberia and northern Russia and northern Canada and Alaska, which hide very deep layer of permafrost that goes back millions of years. Now, this permafrost is melting, especially at the bottom of lakes, and releasing methane at a pretty fast, or faster rate, I guess. Does Professor Pollack, do you factor in these fast reserves of methane clathrate that are waiting to come out of the Earth and its ability to cook the heat in the atmosphere when you're talking about how fast the Earth could heat up?
Yes, I think the scientific community is indeed aware of these important sources of additional greenhouse gas, both the methane locked in the permafrost and methane locked in a form of ice in the ocean floor, which was the clathrate that your listener just remarked on. The question is how fast do you destabilize those regions? In the case of the permafrost, the melting is taking place from the top down, and that's, fortunately, a fairly slow process. And so while the emissions of methane from the defrosting permafrost are real, the pace at which it would liberate the entire column may be a little bit longer time scale than simply the melting of the surface.
Thanks for calling, Michael. Here's an email from John, who's in St. Louis, Missouri. He says the popular assumption today is that climate change is a man-made phenomenon, but how do we know it's not part of the cyclical climate changes of warming and cooling that have been documented throughout the Earth's geological history?
Well, that's always a good question, because we know that climate has changed long before there were people on Earth. And so what we try to understand what the natural forcings of climate are, and then ask, are those the factors that are producing it today? And when you do take that track, you discover that the sun, which of course is a natural factor that fluctuates in its energy, in the last half of the 20th century, it was actually diminishing somewhat in its radiative output. So that can't be the cause of the warming. Another natural factor are volcanic eruptions, which spew dust and aerosols into the atmosphere and block sunshine for a while. And if there were an absence of volcanism for long periods, then the sky would get clearer and we'd get more sunshine and it would warm. But in fact, the last half of the 20th century actually had quite a few volcanoes. There was Agung, there was El Chichon, there was Mount Pinatubo, and all of those tended also to cause some slight cooling. So the question is, what led to the warming? And there we must go to examine the human factors.
Henry Pollack, his new book is titled A World Without Ice, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's take another caller in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning, Gary. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. This is a very simple question. With the ever-increasing need for fresh water as time goes on, is there a possibility that all of this rising ocean water may be used in desalinization to meet our needs for fresh water?
Well, you don't need to raise sea level to have access to ocean water. It's there in great abundance right now. The question is, can we desalinate it economically and at a scale that we can use it in widespread applications, both in our cities and in our agricultural regions? I actually think that desalinization will become competitive as a source of fresh water far sooner than we might imagine, just because water is, in effect, the resource of the 21st century, just as petroleum might have been considered the resource of the 20th century. Water is going to be a limiting factor in so many things, and the sooner we learn to desalinate efficiently, the better.
Now, here's the voice of another skeptic. This is Bill. He says the reality is that global warming is caused by the solar output and has increased, along with the Earth, our neighbor planets are warming. This is a natural sun cycle. It's doubtful our limited efforts to stop warming is going to prove useful. Too many people stand to make a fortune from the likely futile efforts to reduce greenhouse gases.
The observation that some other planets are warming also is real, but you have to ask carefully what are the reasons in each case.
And how do we know that?
Well, there are astronomical ways to look at the atmospheres of the outer planets and determine their temperature. And one of them that has apparently warmed some is the former planet Pluto, now being demoted to a...
Really?
But if Pluto's warming were indeed due to solar output, then Earth would be cooked. The Earth is so much closer to the sun than Pluto. So you can't attribute that to increased output from the sun just because every planet closer than Pluto would have an increment of temperature far bigger than Pluto. Mars has shown some warming, but it almost is certainly due to changes in the in its reflectivity of sunshine. Mars has a lot of dust storms that block sunshine, and if the dust storms slow down or clear, then Mars gets more sunshine at its surface and it warms. So, but it's not, again, solar output that has changed. It's the weather on Mars that has changed. So I disagree with your reader or your listener.
Okay, and let's go to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, how you doing? I had a question. You were on the international weather study. Did you ever go to Greenland to see the water, those waterfalls going down below the ice sheet?
I have been to Greenland, and I've seen some examples of that. There are some very famous photographs now of surface melting, plunging down huge cracks in the ice, and going all the way to the base of the ice and lubricating it.
Okay, my question is, from the pictures, I can't get a sense of what size. What size are those holes?
Well, the fractures are sometimes several miles long, and they're like cracks, so they're not that wide, but they're very big fissures that you wouldn't want to fall into, and they plunge all the way to the base of the ice sheet.
All right, my last question, does the volume slow down or stop at night when the sun's not there, or is it just flowing all the time?
Well, of course, as you get to the higher latitudes in the summer, the sun is up a greater and greater fraction of the day, and above the Arctic Circle, there are times when it's up 24 hours a day. So in the case of Greenland, you're seeing long periods of melting, separated by only a few hours of dusk. And so it's not as if there's a day-night cycle that would lead to refreezing.
Well, thank you for your time. I appreciate that.
Thanks for calling. And here is an email from Dr. Keita, who says, I'm an anthropologist interested in the Sahara. Will the rivers in Africa, the Nile, the Niger, increase in volume? Will the Saharan lakes of the early Holocene return, making for more agricultural possibilities?
Most of the projections for Africa, unfortunately, go the other direction. They forecast a increasing desiccation of central and equatorial Africa. And so the return of the Great Lakes, Lake Chad and the like, and the other rivers that once made the Sahara much greener, it doesn't look like it's in the works for the next few centuries.
Now, why would that be?
When you change the climate of the globe, you change the patterns of where the precipitation falls and where it comes from. And in other words, if it falls more in one place, it has to dry out somewhere else. And so most of the projections of the future try to look at the long-term trends in precipitation as well as temperature. And they don't bode well for Africa.
Henry Pollack, he's professor of geophysics at the University of Maryland. His new book is titled A World Without Ice. I congratulate you, sir. Thank you for being here.
It's been my pleasure, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.